Good morning, everyone. Thank you for being here. And thank you to my co-panelists and to our moderator. We've heard about scripture. We've heard about international experience. Now I'm going to speak about a somewhat narrow, but also very broad and deep take on this one Supreme Court case. A lot's happened at the Supreme Court, and I figured time is short. Let's stick to one case if we can, but tie it into this conference. And there's basically three movements to this talk. So sort of what we should want, right? What the law is, and what we can reasonably hope for. That's kind of where we're going. So this is what we should want. We, the attendees of a conference, of this particular conference, is recognition of prenatal personhood. The dignity of human beings is recognizing the human as a person. But the Supreme Court teaches that humans are not persons until born. So why prenatal personhood? Because it's true. Because it's true. A person is a member of the moral community. Those of you who heard Alistair McIntyre's talk and his emphasis on justice, a person is one to whom one's own is due as a matter of justice. A person, to think about the title of our conference, a person is a you, capable of being called by name. And think about some of the scripture that Noel alluded to. A person is formed in the womb before being born. Everyone knows this, right? Jeremiah speaks of that, or the Jeremiah 1. And think about, from a Catholic perspective, when we think about birth, which the Supreme Court will treat as a sort of necessary condition of personhood, well, think of the joyful mysteries of the Rosary. The Annunciation and the Visitation precede the Nativity. The most significant event in human history, the Incarnation, was not accomplished with the Nativity. Right? So we know that you're a person before you're born. But recognition by whom? So I said the Supreme Court is saying, at least under the 14th Amendment, not until you're born. The recognition that we need is actually by the people of the United States, by the people of each state, and by government officials in all branches of government. So let's not get excessively focused on the Supreme Court. They're blockers as a matter of federal law. But let's keep our eye on the ball. Here's what Roe versus Wade says. The word person is used in the 14th Amendment does not include the unborn. So people are asking, this is a case called Dobbs. It's one of four abortion cases at the court. And people are asking, is the Supreme Court going to overrule Roe versus Wade? And this is the question on everyone's mind. It's actually a hard question to answer because, at least from a legal perspective, it can mean a lot of different things. You know, there are aspects of Roe versus Wade that have already been overruled. For example, its trimester framework. And just, sorry to go into technical details, but parts of Roe have been overruled, but with no improvement for unborn babies and a sort of disastrous decision in Planned Parenthood versus Casey involves some like partial overruling. What people usually mean when they ask this question is the Supreme Court going to get out of the business of scrutinizing and invalidating prohibitions and regulations of abortion? And I think the answer to that is yes, mostly. But, yes, mostly, right? So another way to think about this is after they do whatever they're going to do, what comes next, right? So the Supreme Court will not get out of abortion cases. I do think hopefully this happens, they won't be addressing first order questions of substantive constitutionality, like looking at a law and saying, does this violate some autonomy right? But instead, second order questions, things like the limits of legislative power of states, conflict of laws, right? Missouri and Illinois, for example, would have very different abortion laws, the limits of congressional legislative power to make laws. So there's all these second order questions. So they won't be out entirely. But it's too early for that, right? These cases are pending. We don't know whether Roe will be overruled. And more importantly, we don't know how. We don't know how, and the details matter. Still, I think we can have a reasonably good sense of what to hope for. But first, let's look at some of the bad things. So the first part of my title is Unwinding the Anti-Magisterium. And here I'm going to talk about, what do I mean by unwinding? I just mean sort of undoing it, right? Sometimes people talk about unwinding a business transaction or unwinding a trade or a certain position or winding down a corporation. There's this whole body of what I would call anti-magisterial teaching on abortion that we want to start unspooling and kind of getting rid of. I don't know that you can just cleanly flip it, okay? All right, but what about the anti-magisterium? So this this comes from University of San Diego professor Steve Smith. He has an essay called The Supreme Court as Anti-Magisterium. So to get at this, let's distinguish first two levels that which we might read a Supreme Court opinion. One might be the legal or doctrinal level, and the other is magisterial. So legal or doctrinal, this is the stuff we teach in introductory courses. It's the stuff that's tested on the bar exam, so-called black letter law, right? There's all sorts of stuff. That's the legal doctrinal. Magisterial includes that, but it's broader. It's where the court speaks to issues such, for our conference, the nature of the human person, or the definition of marriage, and sort of has cultural power that's separate from its legal force. So magisterial is a teaching function. So then, okay, so we have that aspect identified. Magisterial would be authoritative teaching. What about an anti-magisterium? So Smith, I think, is really interesting here. He says the Supreme Court is a kind of anti-magisterium in that it uses its authority to teach that there is no authoritative teaching. So it's an inverted magisterium, sort of upside down. It's a peculiar type of magisterium, though. It's sort of like the same way that an anti-hero is still a hero. He also talks about antimatter and matter, but I don't understand physics well enough, so I'm not going to mention that. Here's the thing, though, and I'm adding this idea. The Supreme Court, the narrative the Supreme Court tells itself and that is sometimes taught, is it's not only that there is no teaching, but it's a heroic anti-magisterial thing in that it saves us from other institutions that will impose orthodoxies. Okay, so what are some examples of this in Roe and Casey? And how do we start getting at this? Okay. Apart from just the law. So let's start with the mystery of human life. So this is from the Casey plurality decision. Mind you, this is in part defining and implementing a conception of liberty. See if you can find it there, right? It says, at the heart of liberty is the right to define one's own concept of existence. You see, it's sort of the magisterial sort of, here's what liberty means. It means you define what liberty means. But we're authoritatively saying that. Existence of meaning of the universe and of the mystery of human life. Straight out of the U.S. reports. Beliefs about these matters could not define the attributes of personhood were they formed under compulsion of the state. And you might ask what type of authority they're exercising here. It's governmental authority. And they are defining liberty. And they're saying that we actually need to have hands-off view of personhood. Okay, so that's an anti-magisterial statement right there. How about Roe versus Wade? So I won't read the whole thing, but you can see the beginning. So Texas had argued, look, we have a duty to protect the unborn, their persons, under the 14th Amendment. But even if you reject that just as a matter of 14th Amendment law, human life begins before birth. And there's well-known facts of fetal development. And so the Supreme Court says, we're out. We need not resolve the difficult question of when human life begins. When those trained in the respective disciplines of medicine, philosophy, and theology are unable to arrive at any consensus, the judiciary, at this point in the development of man's knowledge, is not in a position to speculate as to the answer. So our answer is, we don't know. Who are we to say when human life begins? Now, what about personhood? This I'll move through kind of quickly because we're not going to do all the legal stuff. But Of course, this is the lead argument. The appellee there is Wade, that is the district attorney in a particular place in Texas. So they argue within the person, the fetus is a person within the language and meaning of the 14th Amendment. In support of this, unsurprisingly, right, they outline at length and in detail the well-known facts of fetal development. Medicine was quite advanced by 1973, right? Like this is, there's plenty that we know about human life. But they said no. Why? There's an absence of case law defining the unborn as persons within the meaning of 14th Amendment. And this ties in a little to the scripture discussion, which is like, yeah, maybe some things are so obvious that they don't need to be litigated. But you don't have 14th Amendment cases until you're saying this is not a person. This, I think, the textual argument is something that's worth taking seriously. References to persons elsewhere in the Constitution seem to have application only postnatally, right? So qualifications for federal office, so on. And then some very shoddy history that's just wrong. Okay, but this is their conclusion, right? The word person as used in the 14th Amendment does not include the unborn. Now, that is not their operative legal principle, though. So there's no personhood. But the state, okay, when they're defining what, when can the state intervene, when can they protect, they drew a line at viability. Okay, so this is the line that they drew and said the state after viability can prohibit abortion. And in Planned Parenthood versus Casey, looking back on Roe, they described the viability line as the central principle of Roe versus Wade. Okay, so now, what can we reasonably hope for in Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health? So first, some strategery. How do you unwind the anti-magisterium? Okay, so the lawyers are making very good arguments. So those pronouncements about the mystery of life and everything, you can't take them head on. You're not going to file a brief that says, actually, the mystery of life is more well-defined, right? Instead, you pin things down into legal and doctrinal points. Once you're there, okay, in the doctrine, the Supreme Court can't escape its orthodoxy announcing function. That's what the Supreme Court does, is it speaks about the meaning of federal law. And there, conventional legal conclusions undermined with conventional legal argument. How does this cash out? Well, there's one other complication, is the Supreme Court sets its own agenda. Okay, they have virtually unfettered discretion, virtually, a little bit fettered, but virtually unfettered discretion. So they can kind of tell us what questions they're going to answer. And this can be a defense mechanism for changes in the law that they don't want. And so they can use this agenda setting function through selecting vehicles. Cases are vehicles for presenting issues. But this is their vulnerability. Just as the anti-magisterial pronouncements can come, they go beyond the legal or doctrinal matters in any particular case, so too can the court walk those back. They have the freedom to do this. So let's look at some constraints on the freedom and what to expect. So in Dobbs, the case came to the court after a very lengthy, unusually lengthy sort of gestational period before they issued cert. So I just pasted in some of the docket entries. They kept going and going. There were a few minor changes, such as in the composition of the court and other things. But at the end, they got to the petition granted, limited to question one. So not only do they get to pick, they can also say, we're only going to answer this one question. Well, what is this one question? Whether all pre-viability prohibitions on elective abortions are unconstitutional. This is why I feel reasonably hopeful that that they're going to have at least a positive outcome. Because look at that categorical thing. So Roe says and Casey says no pre-viability. But look, the lawyers, you get this question, there is a single word answer to that. No, right? Are all pre-viability prohibitions on elective abortions unconstitutional? No. Okay, now what though? How does that apply to Mississippi's law in that case? So Mississippi law prohibits abortions after 15 weeks gestational age. And I do think the Supreme Court is likely to reject the constitutional challenge. They've narrowed it. They've made it categorical. But what does this do for the anti-magisterial aspect of things, right? How do we, because we care about not just the outcome in 15 weeks, but what comes next? And how do we think about human life? So here's the thing, is to reject the constitutional challenge to a post 15 weeks ban, the court doesn't have to say anything about personhood. It doesn't. It can stay in the line drawing business. Right, so this would be a big deal to stay in the line drawing business and just draw it a little earlier, right? So 15 weeks, that's late enough. There's been enough development. The court doesn't want to do this though. Why? Because then there's this case after case, and it's very bad. It wants to get out of the line drawing business, but here is a word of caution: they don't want to get into the line drawing business on the other side. Okay, so in extricating itself from the line drawing business, dealing with claims that state prohibitions are too early, the court does not want to open federal courts to claims that state lines are too late, right? That states are too permissive. I'm just going to posit that they don't want to do that. They don't want to adjudicate claims that states are insufficiently protective. They don't want to admit it. Okay, but this is one big reason why they are unlikely to affirm prenatal personhood. I think this is a reality that we need to, that doesn't mean we have to accept it, we can argue against it, but we work within it right now. And why? Because affirmation of 14th Amendment prenatal personhood gives rise to a duty not to deny the equal protection of the laws to the unborn. And okay, so what does Mississippi argue? This is from their brief, and they bring in rational basis review, which for non-lawyers is kind of the standard approach to all legislation when there's not some sort of special right at issue. And all it asks is whether a law is rationally related to a legitimate governmental interest. It's usually very easy to satisfy. You only get there, though, if there's no special right, so it would be nice. Okay. So here's what I'd like to see them do, okay, to kind of get personhood in a certain way. So the way they define the interest that kicks in at viability in Roe and Casey is as in the potentiality of human life. See, they after saying we don't know when human life begins, well, at least you can protect the potentiality at viability. That's kind of mushy, right? Why not just say something like, Mississippi thinks that by 15 weeks gestational age, human beings are worthy of protection as persons. Now, we said in Roe that these are not persons, but the court doesn't have to actually do more than say this law is reasonably related to a legitimate governmental interest. So acknowledge, look at the detailed legislative findings that Mississippi made about fetal development. You can look, they're in the law. Think about things like social facts, people sharing 3D ultrasounds. This is 15 weeks, what everyone knows about 15 weeks. So it's just reasonable to protect these as persons. And everyone recognizes bodily integrity of persons. Protection of that is within the duty as a government. And so it's legitimately related to that interest. So this is the bottom line, right? Even if the court does not affirm prenatal personhood, it should negate Roe's negation of prenatal personhood. Okay? I think that is achievable. And think back now to this anti-magisterium and think, who are we to disagree? Well, this will open the door. It might not seem like a lot. It might not seem like a home run. But it actually would open the door to more legislation based on perceived personhood. So if the court just takes the stance that it lacks judicially manageable standards to replace its perception of personhood, categorical not until birth, with Congress's or the state government's perception, that's enough to uphold the laws. So we use this logic as an antidote to the abortion anti-magisterium, and we will have an anti-heroic magisterium for the protection of prenatal persons. Thank you.